Welcome back to Class Act, Updates in Education Law. I'm Miriam.
I'm Lisa.
And we are attorneys at Walter Haverfield in Cleveland. We practice school law, and every few weeks we get together and we talk about the latest legal developments relevant to board members, administrators, school employees, really anybody who works with kids in our schools.
Right, Miriam, and today we are starting our in-depth look on Title IX, which is a really fascinating but also very broad law, and it affects both school districts and also higher education universities and colleges, and in many ways from how they address student bullying to sexual violence, employee discrimination, transgender issues, and even school sports. So we are going to dive into that topic today and explore background, really how the law has developed in key areas for board members and educators to kind of have some background knowledge to understand why these things are in place. And as we discuss that, we have our colleague with us, Ben Chonacki. Welcome.
Hi, Ben. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me here. I'm excited to dig into this exciting topic. I get to work in this stuff a fair amount, and it's pretty interesting. The law itself is relatively straightforward, but as with anything, once you start trying to apply that to real-world situations, it gets pretty dicey. It
gets tricky. So, Ben, can you give us a little bit of background just about this law, Title IX? What is it? How did it come about?
Sure. So Title IX is the ninth chapter of the Education Amendments Act of 1972. It's arguably the most famous chapter in law, but there's a lot of confusion regarding its enforcement and compliance. The act was enacted as a follow-up to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Mm-hmm. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 famously prohibited discrimination in the workplace and public accommodations on the basis of race, religion, sex, national origin, the traditional protected classes.
However, but that only applied in the workplace, right? It didn't apply to schools.
Correct. So that shortcoming became apparent as the act was enforced and implemented. It was clear that there needed to be an accommodation specifically for females in education programs. Mm-hmm. So legislators drafted this separate law, which became the Education Amendments Act of 1972. And the law itself is relatively short.
It's pretty short.
So even though it affects many broad areas, the actual language we pull from is pretty direct, right?
Correct. It's kind of a standard legislative practice. They paint with a broad brush and then start to fill in through administrative regs and executive agency interpretations.
So let's give them listeners that language.
Sure. So the legislature in the Act, Title IX, the actual meat on the bones, mm-hmm. provides that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance.
So basically, if you receive federal funds, you cannot discriminate based on sex in any education programs. And that's it. That's the whole law.
Correct. Right. Yeah, there are certain exceptions for religious institutions and military schools and so on, but generally, that is the law. Now, the focus initially was on athletics.
Sports, right? School sports, for some reason. Even though sports is not actually mentioned in the law itself, from what I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the initial cases, that was all about school sports.
Correct. So sports is one of the kind of the obvious examples where there's a clear disparate treatment, particularly in the 70s, between men and women. So mm-hmm. it was a clear and easy advocacy point to say sports is not equal right now. Let's get it equal as soon as possible.
And just to be clear, Title IX applies not only to colleges and universities, but also to K-12 school districts.
Correct. So Title IX applies to any educational institution receiving federal financial assistance. And that includes private colleges, private state educational institutions, whatever the case might be.
And one of the main ways Title IX is enforced is through the Office for Civil Rights, which was established in, I think, 1980. Can you tell us, Ben, a little bit about the Office for Civil Rights?
Sure.
And its role?
So the Office of Civil Rights is a federal agency. It's run by the Assistant Secretary of Education. Mm-hmm. That person is appointed by the sitting president, and their job is to enforce and interpret Title IX and the corresponding regulations. So there are regulations that inform what this statute means. So there's a code of federal regulations that say, what does it mean for no person shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation.
So there's many details that that are part of this law, even though they're not explicitly in the law. And those details are fleshed out, is that what you're saying, by the regulations which are developed by the Office for Civil Rights? Is that how you frame it?
Yes, there's two pieces to it. So there's the actual federal regulations, which are codified in the Code of Federal Regulations.
Okay.
Those regulations are specifically articulated and they have the force of law.
Okay.
They go through a rulemaking process where the executive agency, in this instance the Department of Education, takes proposed laws and they publish them. The public gets to comment on them, and there's a comment and back and forth period.
There's like a notice and comment period.
Correct.
And that's done so that the public has a chance to weigh in on these regulations.
Exactly. So it's quasi-legislative, but it has the effect of law.
So we've talked about OCR often in our podcast prior and other areas, mm-hmm. and their role in enforcing these with school districts, following up on complaints, investigating, and giving this guidance. We've talked about Dear Colleague letters before.
Correct.
And those are often one of the modes that OCR gives guidance to K-12 schools. Mm-hmm. So how have you seen OCR's involvement with Title IX?
So big picture, the OCR gets involved because those regs are somewhat ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And so what the Office of Civil Rights does is their job is to make sure that any educational institution receive federal financial assistance is complying with that law.
Okay.
But in order to accomplish that Herculean task, one of the things that they do is they publish these Dear Colleague letters. These Dear Colleague letters typically say, the regulations say this, we interpret this to mean that.
Okay.
And the idea is that although it's not law, it's guidance to the educational institution receiving federal financial assistance for how they need to comport their activities on a going forward basis.
Okay, so we have the law, and then we have regulations that explain the law, and then we have the guidance from the Office for Civil Rights that further clarifies the regulations as they apply to schools in a practical way.
Right, and sometimes these Dear Colleague letters or guidance can be kind of controversial because it doesn't always go through that comment period. So sometimes when OCR is issuing these Dear Colleague letters, it's their interpretation of these regulations and how they should be applied in these environments, but without the role of kind of the full legislature process.
Yeah, I think that I've heard about this in the news a little bit where people get upset that the notice and comment period was skipped over, so they feel like a government agency just put forth regulations or put forth guidance without any input from the public. Is that kind of...
Yeah, I think that's accurate. So one of the things that gets really dicey is these Dear Colleague letters, these policy interpretations are articulated by an administration, an executive agency, and the executive agency's taking instruction from the executive.
And the president.
Precisely. So what you have is a situation where, unlike the statute, which doesn't change, or the rules, which are really hard to change,
right.
Every 4 years you get a new administration, and that administration is likely going to have some different interpretations of that law.
Mm.
And the challenge is, and there's no clearer example than what you see between the two terms of the Department of Education under President Obama and the Department of Education under current President Trump. Those regulations or that administrative guidance has gone one way, and then with the election of President Trump, it's gone another way.
So a good example would be like the transgender issues we've talked about previously and can dive into in another episode a little bit more, where there had been specific guidance and it's been withdrawn by the Office of Civil Rights.
Exactly.
So let's dive into a little bit more of how OCR enforces these laws and what that looks like.
Sure. The Office of Civil Rights, they have brick and mortar offices, and those offices are in different jurisdictions throughout the country.
Okay.
And there are parents, students, anybody who's involved or related to or has standing to bring a claim or an issue where they are or someone they are responsible for is experiencing discrimination in an educational program.
On the basis of sex?
Correct.
Okay.
If they are subject to that type of discrimination, then the Office of Civil Rights is tasked with the investigation and enforcement of the law.
So in other words, a parent files a complaint saying, you know, my daughter was treated differently because of her sex, because she's a female in this school environment. And that can be a college setting, or it can be high school or elementary school even.
Correct. And so that arises in a lot of different contexts. And it arises everything from in the athletics context. You've got the example of there's 20 men's sports to one female sport. That that type of dichotomy gives rise to a Title IX investigation.
That seems to be the more common area that the public knows about.
I would say that's probably the more high-profile but less frequent example. Probably the more frequent example and the more common cases are actual instances in the classroom or in other extracurricular activities where you have teachers or administration responsible for ensuring programs are administered in a non-discriminatory fashion, who either intentionally or unintentionally are providing those educational benefits in a way that is disproportionately affecting one sex or the other.
So like grading girls harsher, or I mean, would that be an example?
So that's an example. Mm-hmm. Usually it's more along the lines of discipline. You'll have an individual who's potentially in trouble for, we'll say, an act of violence. The Title IX complaint might come in because they're saying that, well, this institution, if incident A happens and it's a male, that person gets this type of discipline. But I'm a female and I received tenfold more discipline, and it's because of my sex.
I was treated harsher because of my sex.
Okay. And as a consequence of that harsh treatment, I'm being deprived of an educational benefit.
Okay.
And that's where the Title IX violation comes in.
Okay.
Once you start being deprived of that educational benefit, Title IX is implicated, and OCR's job is to investigate and prepare a report, and if necessary, reach an agreement or potentially litigate the matter of noncompliance.
So we handle those kind of complaints on a pretty frequent basis, not necessarily just for Title IX, but more globally. And what that looks like for our listeners is generally an investigation period where they collect a lot of documents, may conduct interviews, gather as much information as possible regarding what the complaint was, and then we see kind of different results from that. Sometimes they're issuing a finding and some proposed solutions to fix that problem. Or sometimes we go through a process of the district decides to enter into like a resolution agreement and say, we're going to take this step and this step to try to rectify the circumstance that's going on.
Now, what's the final authority that the Office for Civil Rights has? Let's say a school district says, you know what, we don't care. We're not going to comply with your proposed remedies or your solutions. We like our school district the way it is, and this is how we do it here.
So the executive branch and Department of Education carries a very, very big stick. They've never used it, but the ultimate stick that they can hit you with if you tell them to buzz off, they can revoke your federal funding.
All federal funding will be gone, and of course that's something that no school district or university ever wants to experience. So typically, school districts and colleges quickly comply when the Office for Civil Rights indicates what solutions, what resolutions they would like to see.
The incentive is to cooperate. Certainly, there is an obligation as legal counsel to ensure that your client's not being railroaded into something that's not appropriate or not reflective of the facts as alleged, but the incentive ultimately is to comply with Title IX and work with OCR as a colleague to resolve a potential issue as opposed to an adversary.
So how has OCR's view and guidance on this specific area in Title IX evolved over the years? Let's maybe point out some of the key Dear Colleague letters that are out there that our districts and universities should be looking at.
Sure. So there's a number of Dear Colleague letters. I would say the big ones from a chronological standpoint, in 2004 there was a Dear Colleague letter that speaks specifically to, as a reminder to institutions, they do have to designate a Title IX coordinator. Believe it or not, that is not something that we always see as a happening. For whatever reason, that formal title is not always being filled by someone within the institution. And so in 2004, OCR decided to make it clear you need to have a designated Title IX coordinator tasked with ensuring that the institution is complying with Title IX.
Every school district and every college and every university must have an individual who is designated to investigate these claims, to look at complaints. And that person is very often called a Title IX coordinator. In your district, it might be that role might be filled by a human resources director, a special education director, the assistant superintendent. But that person is, I just want to make this as clear as possible, that person is always there. I remember a case I had once where there was a deposition and a student's attorney was talking to a teacher and he said, look, you know, how this is a bullying complaint and how come you didn't follow your district's policy and forward this bullying complaint to the Title IX coordinator? And in the middle of this deposition, this teacher turns to me and she says, do we even have that? I don't think we have that here.
And we talk about the importance of policies frequently, right? And that district staff need to know what's in there. But that is really accurate. Often they do reference having a Title IX coordinator and it's not always identified who that person is. Or district staff other than administrators, such as teachers, don't always know who that is or who a complaint should go to.
We've even had situations where the Title IX coordinator is like, oh, I didn't know. I am the Title IX coordinator. You know, which we would prefer that you never be in that situation. So just make sure as an administrator that you know who your Title IX coordinator is, perhaps it's you, and that your staff all know who the Title IX coordinator is according to your policies.
So what's some other key guidance that OCR has given?
So some of the more prominent guidance typically relates to one of two areas. One is sexual violence, sexual harassment. And there's been a lot of back and forth over which administration gets to articulate the policy or the interpretation of the regs on those Dear Colleague letters. Probably the most widely reported Dear Colleague letter was the 2011 letter that provided guidance from the Obama administration about how to respond to sexual violence. That Dear Colleague letter was subsequently withdrawn in September of 2017.
This is very controversial.
Correct.
Yeah, a lot of media coverage,
A lot of media coverage on this. And I think we're going to devote a full episode to this topic because it's so interesting and controversial.
It certainly warrants one. And one of the big things that you need to be clear about is that well, I guess for the purposes of this discussion, the important thing is that one of the main reasons that the Dear Colleague letter was withdrawn was in part because the Trump administration has taken the position that sexual violence should be something that's codified into the Code of Federal Regulations as law to allow for a little bit more certainty for how sexual violence should be handled on a going forward basis.
And not just leaving that to whatever current administration is governing OCR at the time.
Correct.
Oh, interesting.
So the other probably major one that often gets discussed is the transgender
guidance.
It's a broad term, but it's generally used to LGBTQ+. So you had a Dear Colleague letter
during the Obama administration.
Correct.
Okay.
Which provided some certainty for how institutions and schools need to be respecting and ensuring there's no discrimination in that context.
And right. Then that was another example of something that was rescinded with this administration.
Right. Correct. Okay. And we again, I believe we'll get into that in another episode.
Yeah.
But that type of policy decision is born out of the ambiguities of how the courts throughout the United States have interpreted what it means to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex in the educational context.
So let's switch gears then from kind of this broad guidance area to what actually has been found in court.
Sure.
Yeah, are there any good cases that you can talk about?
Yeah, I'm like really excited to jump in. I apologize, but I get like real fired up over like Title IX cases.
Okay.
It's weird.
That's why we have you here.
It's bizarre because I have no good reason to other than I like.
It's
and
an
I like
interesting
reading
area,
cases and
definitely.
I like arguing about
yeah,
things.
Yeah, it's an interesting area.
So there's a couple of seminal cases which really speak to some of the basics, nuts and bolts of what Title IX is all about. And the cases I guess we should be talking about first and foremost are the cases that provide you guidance for what the actual law means for the purposes of everyday application. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably the first prominent case that we should talk about is Franklin versus Gwinnett County Public Schools.
That's in Georgia, right? I think Gwinnett County is in Georgia. Okay.
I believe it is, yeah. And so, big picture, the Supreme Court holds that money damages are available to individuals who are harmed by an educational institution's failure to comply with Title IX.
In other words, if you have a Title IX problem going on in your school district, you can sue that school district now after Gwinnett County and get money for it.
Correct.
So I think, you know, before this case, it was just more of this is what school districts should be doing, this is the regulations, this is the guidance. But after this case, now there's much more of a bite to it.
Correct. So I would say there are cases prior to Franklin versus Gwinnett County that stood for the same basic principle, mm-hmm. but Franklin's significant because it really does highlight the fact that the damages available are to a student and they are cash money real,
wow.
not the abstract.
So mm-hmm. we're not just talking about your federal funding, right. such as like from OCR and what they can find. We're mm-hmm. talking about the student who makes the claim and takes it to court can actually get money from the district right. as the remedy.
Correct.
And that has happened. Certainly, students have filed in federal court, and some cases have even gone all the way up to the Supreme Court, and then they have, if they've proven their case, they do get funds, either in a settlement or through a jury trial.
Right, and what's also important about this case, this was a U.S. Supreme Court case, right? So it's...
applies it to everyone.
Right.
Nationally.
So it's not just your local, decision. What circuit or district you're in. Mm-hmm. This will apply across the country.
Yeah, I would say it's been well settled for a long time that the law of the land is if you are violating Title IX and a student wants to bring a claim mm-hmm. to... make you pay, mm-hmm. they can.
Yep.
So there's also a case out there that's kind of significant to women's sports, right?
Well, there's a number of them. Yeah. There's a whole bunch, but one of the ones that it's ripe for us to talk about today is Cohen versus Brown University. It's not mm-hmm. a Supreme Court case, but it's one of a line of cases that really speak to the issues that arise in the Title IX athletics context. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the first cases where you have a student athlete, and this is at Brown University, so in the higher education context,
yep.
who was attempting to, or in this case it was a group of student athletes who were attempting to be treated equally. And as long
so
as,
female student athletes.
Correct. Right. So there were two women's sports teams mm-hmm. at the university who were, the institution made the choice to demote the sports teams from an institutional sponsored event, meaning the university was going to sponsor and pay for the athletics budget or the expenses of participation.
But only for the boys team?
Well, no. So they were originally doing it for both.
Okay.
But then they made the decision. This is typically what happens in the Title IX athletics context. Mm-hmm. The institution has to make a decision based on the limited funds they have available mm-hmm. As to how are we going to fund our athletics department.
Sure.
And in this case, the institution made the decision to demote two women's sports teams from the institution-funded context to the donor. Basically, they had to find their own funding if they wanted to continue to operate.
So like a club sport.
Exactly, yeah.
So and often, then, I mean, that is an analysis in a university or school district, I think, that from the start of the conversation makes sense. You're looking at how much money you have that's limited, mm-hmm. what you should devote it to. I would think certainly at the university level, there are certain male sports that bring in more money mm-hmm. because of just how they are out there, people who attend them versus female sports. Mm. So this is kind of a shift in how the districts need to make that analysis.
So what did the First Circuit say?
So it, big picture, the First Circuit said that you can't do that.
Okay.
I mean, really, it boils down to there, and it's a First Circuit decision, so different circuits have different rules, but the principle that applies across the board is the same, and Cohen was the first case to articulate that principle, and that is basically you cannot have a disproportionate number of male to female benefit for athletics.
And it doesn't yeah. matter if you can't just say, oh, well, you know what, girls are less interested in sports, so that's why it makes sense that we devote more money to the boys' sports, right?
Generally, yes. There's okay. there is a considerable amount of guidance that, mm-hmm. that the OCR has provided since and prior to Cohen that mm-hmm. speaks to these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And big
I think we should have you back for an episode on that, too.
I think we should. It's weird. It's like we have it planned already. Yes, so that's Cohen. And then I guess to hit on a few other cases that mm-hmm. are probably more applicable to your school boards and, mm-hmm. and to a broader extent to the athletics departments,
mm-hmm.
There's a number of cases from both district courts within the Sixth Circuit where we do most of our practice and
sure.
throughout the country that stand for the principle that at the high school level, when you're dealing with scheduling, you're
mm-hmm.
dealing with uniforms, you're dealing with game times,
mm-hmm.
practice times,
mm-hmm.
practice fields,
mm-hmm.
those types of decisions that are made at the athletics department level or at the conference level or at the statewide athletic association level, those decisions made by those decision makers are one, They are state actors for the purposes of the act. So they are, and they are subject to Title IX. Mm-hmm. So your provision of fields, your provision of uniforms, all those things are all subject to the requirements of Title IX, and they cannot be discriminatory against one sex or the other.
Okay. Another case I think that we wanted to touch upon was Davis versus Monroe. And that is a 1999 case that went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it had really wide reaching ramifications for school districts.
Right. Harassment and bullying are kind of tied to this
sexual
case,
they... sexual harassment. This was kind of a crazy case.
Yeah. So Davis versus Monroe is a big Supreme Court case.
Mm-hmm.
It's important. Simple facts are you had a fifth grader who was complaining about being touched by...
a classmate.
Correct. She reported the teacher. The teacher didn't take any action. Wasn't
inappropriate sexual touching. And this was at the, I guess, elementary school level. So that's right. Interesting. And this was also going on for a long period of time. I think that was part of the...
Yeah, what you had is a prolonged assault.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the consequence of that was the teacher, who was aware of the problem, was not taking any disciplinary action. They were not taking steps to ensure that the student was being afforded the opportunity to have a
educational benefit.
Correct.
Right, and this case does a nice job of kind of outlining what the standard is then moving forward for what districts or other entities are required to do.
Correct. So when you end up in court in a private cause of action, which Franklin creates, you're subject to, or you might get sued under several different theories mm-hmm. under Title IX violations. But the most prominent theory and the one that you see most often in the sexual violence, sexual harassment, mm-hmm. assault type case, mm-hmm. is this theory called the deliberate indifference
right.
standard. And so the idea is that your educational institution cannot be deliberately indifferent to a known act of discrimination mm-hmm. which occurred while the individual or the student is under the control of the institution.
And I think that, Lisa, you and I have talked about deliberate indifference when we did our series on bullying. And deliberate indifference in the school context is a clearly unreasonable response in light of the known circumstances. And I think this case is so important because it's the first one that really says, okay, there's a law saying that you can't discriminate based on sex, and that's what's happening when a child or a young adult is being harassed sexually. So, you know, that's kind of taking that law, which just seems very short and clear, and applying it to circumstances that maybe you wouldn't expect to apply it to. But the Supreme right. Court said sexual harassment, if the school district is deliberately indifferent, if it's acting unreasonably in light of the known circumstances, then the school district can be held liable under Title IX. You may have to pay out for damages for this young adult's therapy or for the loss of the education that resulted. In this case, you know, this girl, her name was LaShonda, she became suicidal, her grades dropped, her quality of life, and definitely the education that she was receiving from the school district was affected, as the Supreme Court found.
Right, and I think what's also important for our listeners to understand with deliberate indifference, it really does impact kind of your whole scope of your process, right,
mm-hmm.
from allegation on through. So you're not going to be held liable if there really is nothing to show you even knew about something going on. But if a teacher had been told by the student or there's other facts that should have prompted an investigation and a district didn't investigate,
mm-hmm.
that might be something that is found to be deliberate indifference, or they investigate and ignore what facts they find, and then you move through that process of what you do about the situation.
Yeah, this was a really interesting case. Are there any other ones that you wanted to touch upon before we wrap up?
No, but mm-hmm. I think Lisa raised two really good points, mm-hmm. and I think it underscores a lot of the discussion that we had today. One is, and you're right on, you really do need to have a policy in place that if someone within your institution is receiving notice of something, that they're doing something about it. And so that person is your Title IX coordinator, like we talked about.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that person, you need to have policies in place so that it's clearly instructed for how to handle it. And the other point is that there is some gray here. So the test we really talked about, it deals with, okay, when does an institution actually know about something?
Right.
Or when is the conduct actually occurring while the students are under the control of the institution. Those types of gray area issues are something that a Title IX coordinator needs to work in cooperation with legal counsel on to make sure that you're wading through that gray area without crossing the line into a Title IX violation.
Right. So some key takeaways for districts today are make sure you have a Title IX coordinator, whatever you want to call them. Make sure they know who they are and your staff knows who they are. Make sure you kind of have outlined a policy regarding these topics. And we can talk about that more in detail
and
in other episodes.
Make sure that your district administrators and teachers and staff know
yes.
about this policy and know the details of the policy and know whom to bring complaints to. And if a student makes a complaint, that shouldn't just get like, oh, okay, I'm going to think about this next week after I do everything else on my plate. That needs to be, in most cases, depending on your policy, immediately brought to the attention of the Title IX coordinator who
Absolutely.
Opens an investigation.
Well, thank you, Ben, for joining us and helping us kind of walk through that background. And
thank you so much, Ben.
Thanks, guys.
I hope you all enjoyed this wonderful podcast. Please rate us highly on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And also, I do want to point out that many of you have sent in interesting questions and interesting emails, and we will get to them. If not during the next episode or two, then certainly right after that. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
The content of this podcast is provided for general information purposes only. The podcast is not legal advice, does not create an attorney-client relationship, and should not be relied upon in making legal decisions. Actions on legal matters should be taken only upon advice of legal counsel. Walter Haverfield does not guarantee the accuracy of information contained in this podcast.